yesterday morning by writing down the curvature 2 forms that we'd computed, and I'm just going to finish off by talking about the Riemann and Ricci tensor. So you can, by looking at this, remember that the curvature 2 form was defined by taking the last two indices of the Riemann tensor and turning them into geometric forms. And therefore, if you look at the way these are written here, you can read off pretty much straight away, in this case, what the Riemann tensor is. So the TR here has only a TR, omega T cross omega R, pair of forms over on the right-hand side. And so that tells you that if you put the indices T and R on the first two components of the Riemann, then the second two indices are also going to have to be T and R. And you can just read off what that is from here. So that's taken care of anything with a T and an R index. And sorry? Because you've got, in this case, is it clear where the two disappeared to? Or is it too early in the morning for anything to be clear? This one. It's way too early in the morning. So the point is, the Riemann tensor is anti-symmetric in its last two indices. And so here, you're summing over C and D here. So in this case, you would have TR, omega T cross omega R, plus RT, omega R cross omega T. But they're both the same because the wedge product is anti-symmetric. So it's the same reason why when you make a two form, it's always a half times the component times omega cross omega. It's just a combinatorial factor. So all I'm doing here is simply reading off from these lines here what we've calculated. So that is the Riemann tensor, all the non-zero components, plus, of course, all the ones you get by the symmetry properties of the Riemann tensor, which I haven't bothered to write down. So it's actually fairly quick to get to the Riemann tensor. And the only thing to notice, I've hatted these indices to just again emphasize that these are the components of the Riemann in an orthonormal basis. So, of course, we normally, when we're writing TR, etc., we're normally actually in our minds thinking of it as a coordinate basis. And so I'd like to transform that to a coordinate basis. In the handout, I've shown how to do that in general by using the individual components of the Feuerbein. However, a sort of cheat way of doing it is simply to note that if you raise the indices So if I raise the R index on the first one, it costs me a minus sign. But because I have, in this case, with my simple orthonormal basis, one T index up and one T index down, the factors in the Fierbein and also the basis of one forms cancel each other out. So this is the same as TR, TR. So I can just, so this is a lazy way of doing it. So I can simply read again off T theta, T theta. And so I simply read them straight off from the other side of the board. So notice that whenever I've got an angular index, I can, in this case, change it between theta and phi, and I get the same component. And that's like a check that you've done things right, because if something is spherically symmetric, you're saying that it has this symmetry around the sphere, and therefore it shouldn't matter where the north pole is. In other words, precisely how you define the theta or phi angle. And so when you see these curvature components coming up and being essentially insensitive to whether it's a theta or a phi, then at least you know you haven't done something dreadfully wrong, okay? Showing the right sort of symmetry property. And of course, from this, it becomes, again, just a question of writing down what the Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar are. So for RTT, we simply have to sum up everything that has a T in it. So here we've got this one and this one twice. Okay, so all I've done there is read, picked from the right-hand board, the relevant components of the Riemann tensor. So here I'm just adding this all up, writing it out in gory detail. So for the A double prime pieces, I've got one here and one here. For the C double prime pieces, I've got two there and two here, because I've got both of the angular directions to add up. A prime, C prime, I've got two there, three, four. And so I'm just simply left with the C prime squared and the 1 over C squared piece. That's clever. There's a page missing in my note. Right, so before I just derive the Schwarzschild solution, I just want to just take a moment to kind of step back and say a little bit about what might have happened if we'd been looking at a different sort of space-time. So what we looked at, if I just clear this and write it over here, we were deciding we were going to look at something extremely physical, which was the space-time around a star. So that's a star in our universe, so that means we're in four dimensions. So all these are just a function of R. So this is something which surrounds a point object in four dimensions. So if we wanted to think about what might happen if we went to more dimensions, you might think this would just simply become a three-sphere or four-sphere or whatever. And so what would change? You'd find the whole thing would go through, the whole calculation would go through in a very similar way. And the only place you'd see differences is when you were doing something with angles, because there'd be more angles. So you're going to look to see, whenever there's one of these functions C of R, what comes along with it. So here is a 2, okay, in front of that A prime, C prime. There's a 2 here. Here's another C term. There's a C term, there's C's in here, but the only place where you've had to think about summing over angles is where the phi theta component. So here you'd still have t theta, but it might be a t theta I. And so you can see how 2 could become n. Similarly here. But in this piece, this is the only part where you might expect something slightly different. And in fact, what happens there is you get a sort of n minus 1, where it's an n sphere. So although we've just done this for four dimensions, it's actually quite easy to do it for any number of dimensions. And that's all that changes. You could decide, well, what if I didn't want to look at something which was a hole? What if I wanted to look where this was just something flat or even something hyperbolic? And in this case, don't worry, I'm just sort of giving you an impression of what happens here. This is the term that would change. That 1 is there, that 1 over c squared is telling you about the curvature of the 2 sphere. And so this might change to a kappa. You can also even add some extra pieces and extend your black hole to make a black brain, in which case you might get additional terms multiplying the A. So although we went through this in full detail for the Schwarzschild solution, if you were to try and compute a more general metric in an arbitrary number of space-time dimensions, you'd find that it would actually look extremely similar to this. And so you would be able to take shortcuts, essentially. Yes, Callum?
Sorry. So, angles on an n-sphere, how many angles can we expect? I know it's a bit of a dumb question, but how best to parameterize an n-sphere?
Well, that just depends. If you don't, if all you're interested in is a spherically symmetric metric, you would probably just do the obvious thing, which is to take the generalization of the normal spherical polars so here you've got normal spherical polars in 3D, and you could, I guess, if you could simply say, well, okay, instead of having cos phi here, I'm going to say this, or sine phi, sine theta, I could change this to sine theta, sine phi, cos chi, or sine theta, sine phi, sine chi. So that would be the obvious thing to do, is to simply just carry on extending and have a sort of a little tree of a unit vector where the expressions just get longer and longer as you go down. But that might not be the way that you want to parameterize it. If you had four dimensions, you could instead have something where you decided to split instead, and I haven't done this with Euler's, anyway, you could split your four-dimensional space into 2 plus 2, each of those is an r squared, in which case you would then have polar angles in each r squared. Now everybody's wondering, why the hell am I saying this? Callum knows, and I think you're sort of, it's a bit mysterious why he's asking this. So the reason why you might want to split things, angles differently, is that the rotation group has a subgroup of sort of commuting, what are they called again? It's too early in the morning.
Subalgebras.
Yeah, right, but it's a killing subalgebra, is it? Or the little group? I'm forgetting the technical names of this. But basically, as in three dimensions, you've always got an invariant axis of a rotation. I always think about this pictorially. And that corresponds to rotations in a plane. And in four dimensions, you can split your four dimensions into two planes. So you now have two independent sort of planes that can rotate separately or together, but completely independently. And so that means in any even number of dimensions, you can sort of just carry on splitting up into these planes. And so if you want to look at rotating black holes, it's probably better to do that. But it really depends on the problem that you've got. If you're not interested in the angular detail, it doesn't matter. You might as well go with the standard coordinatization of S3. So now we can read off what the Einstein tensor is. In general, Okay, I left, I was very deliberate in choosing these functions A, B, and C and leaving them arbitrary. And I mentioned at the time this was equivalent to a choice of gauge. So you've been hearing about choices of gauge, I think certainly in Renata's course, and I'm not sure about cosmology or not. But all we really mean by a choice of gauge in general relativity is just a choice of coordinates. And in the context of this metric, the only coordinate that we haven't pinned down from the symmetries of the metric is the R coordinate. And I mentioned that you could rescale R to any arbitrary function of R, which would allow you to change what these functions A, B, and C were. So it may be convenient to choose a particular expression in a particular case. So common choices in this case we could choose C equals R. Then this part here would look very familiar. It would simply be the angular part of your metric in polar coordinates. This is what's known as an area gauge because the area of a two-sphere in this gauge is 4 pi R squared. So it says that the area of a sphere is exactly what you would expect it to be. Another choice of gauge might be A equals 1 over B. Now, in practice, when you try and solve the Einstein equations, you're not really very sure up front in which coordinate system these functions will look simple. So we could have gone in and put R squared there, and in fact in this case we would have been okay, it wouldn't have been a problem. But sometimes it's better to just leave a slight amount of freedom in the equations of motion, because when you come to solving them you might spot that a particular combination has a very nice counterpart on the right-hand side in terms of energy momentum. So maybe some combination of the components of the energy momentum vanishes, but that corresponds on the left-hand side to some particular choice of R. So in this case, A equals 1 over B, you're saying that this metric function GTT is just inversely proportional to the GRR, which is, of course, what the Schwarzschild solution is. And this is something where there's a solution in a sort of four-dimensional stringy black hole, where A and B have nice analytic expressions if you choose A equals 1 over B. So it may be that you make a gauge choice and then you find, oh, you know, there's no obvious solution. I have to do this numerically. But if you'd been craftier and chosen a different gauge, you would actually have an analytic solution. Another choice might be B equals 1, in which case R would be the proper radial distance. Because you just have dr squared there. You could choose A equals B, you could do all sorts of stuff. But often, if you choose, you know, have some particular way of fixing your radial coordinate, you find that there are nice analytic solutions. to the other functions. So we'll choose the first gauge because this happens to be the gauge in which our matrix looks nice. So if C is R, then C double primed obviously vanishes. Signs right. Minus 2, that's plus. Minus. But notice 2b primed on b cubed is just 1 over b squared differentiated. So this whole thing is just a total derivative times 1 over r squared. So in fact, this is already suggesting that, this is sort of telling us why choosing C equals R was quite a nice gauge choice, because it, from Einstein's equations, if I look at what this derivative here is, you see that the metric function b squared is just depending on an integral of t naught naught. So if I just write down grr before I clean the right board. So if I'm just going to say, let's just ask what a vacuum solution is. Let's suppose there's no matter and find the most general spherically symmetric solution. Then that's completely straightforward to integrate. Oops, she says, failing to integrate it properly. So in other words, 1 over b squared is 1 minus c over r. So I have 1 minus some constant over r. Then if I look at the combination of gtt and grr here, you see that the second terms, this, and that term are the same. So what I get is that in vacuum again, the sum of A prime and A, B prime and B is zero. So that tells me that A squared is proportional to 1 over B squared. And I can use my rescaling of time, I mean, I can still rescale time by a constant, to say that A squared is exactly 1 on B squared. So I've essentially just derived the Schwarzschild solution. The reason I wanted to set a squared equal to 1 over b squared is so that as I go off to infinity, the coefficient multiplying dt squared is 1. So what I've got here is something which is Minkowski space plus an extra bit. So asymptotically, this tends to Minkowski space, and we say this space-time is asymptotically flat. So obviously we'd like to identify what C is, and for that our constant, perhaps I shouldn't have used C, if I look at the actual equation for 1 on b squared, and if I integrate it up, notice that this expression here is 2g times 4 pi r squared t naught naught. So if I take an integral, then you see that this is just the integral d3x t naught naught, which is going to be the mass contained within the sphere. So in other words, outside, as long as we're weakly gravitating, that is, so there's not a strong back reaction on the energy momentum tensor, it tells me that C is 2gm. So that's the Schwarzschild solution. But actually, it's not difficult to see what would happen if we generalized our solution not just to a vacuum, but to a cosmological constant, because a cosmological constant is just something proportional to the metric. And so all I would have here would be lambda r squared, and I can integrate that just fine. And so I would end up with r over b squared equaled 1 minus lambda over 3, not 1, r minus lambda over 3 r cubed minus a constant. And so that would change my Schwarzschild solution to having a minus lambda on 3 r squared. So with very little effort, I've got, you know, quite a wide range of these solutions. So if I'm in Dusseter space, positive cosmological constant, I have two horizons. So if lambda's greater than 0, so remember, horizon is where, essentially, where A goes to 0. But if lambda is negative, so anti-de Sitter space, then you don't get a second horizon. So that's just... sort of looking at a slightly more general black hole solution. So let's just take rather than continuing with formalism, let's actually sort of take a closer look at black holes. And first of all, see whether we expect these objects to exist in our universe, or whether this is just some very idealized special type of solution which you may never access in sort of, you know, normal conditions. So in order to explore this, I'm just going to go back to these equations of motion here, but think a little bit more about a matter source and look at what we might get if we put in some sort of source for our star. So, as I commented over here, I'm just going to define M of R to be this integral of T naught naught throughout the volume. So that's my definition of M of R. But then I also need to think about the other components of the Einstein tensor. So if I look at the RR equation, and the RR equation is going to be related to the pressure. So you'll be used in cosmology to having a fluid source for your energy momentum, where you approximate the matter that you have by something where there's an energy density, so it's just a simple fluid, incompressible fluid, where there's an energy density and a pressure, but no shears, no strains, just two functions, rho and p. So I can, by inputting what my b squared is, I can rearrange that. That's the second sort of second gravitational equation. Now we could look at the third, the theta components of the Einstein equations, but instead of that, we'll do again like in cosmology. You often, rather than looking at the Reicha-Arturi equation, you might look at conservation of energy momentum. We'll use this same alternative here. So if I look at the R component of my energy momentum conservation, if I take B equals R, then here I've got to take A is R, here I'm summing over these connection components, and here I'm taking B equals R. Is that a question? Pressure. So isotropic fluid. So we've got rho is energy density, and P is your pressure. You have done rho P in cosmology, yeah? It's just the same thing, so it's the same idea. So just as since we know we're going to need our connection, if we look at the mixed components of the connection, then we know it's A primed on A if it's TT. It's going to be B primed on B if it's RR. And it's going to be 1 on R if it's theta or phi. Okay? Similarly, the RAB, which is going to be minus a half GRR GAB primed for A and B being T, theta, or phi. So this is going to give, if we've got TT, we're going to have AA primed on B squared, and it's going to be minus R on B squared for the angles. And so all we do then is simply put it into the conservation of energy momentum equation. So the first term is just a derivative of P. The second one is P over B squared into the trace of this thing here. And then the final one, so let's see, that's going to be rho 1 over B squared in front of everything. So in each case, because I've got both of the indices upstairs on the energy momentum tensor, I have to raise, because it sort of gives me a factor of 1 over b squared when I'm raising the r index, or a factor of 1 over r squared if I'm raising a theta index. So that's the reason for those relative factors there. So this here straightforwardly cancels. You can see that when I take the derivative here, I get a p primed on b squared, and then I've got minus 2 p b primed on b, which is going to go with these two here. And so what I end up with is something which is quite reminiscent of the cosmology equation, where you would have rho dot plus 3h rho plus p equals 0. Here it's a little different because we've got now things depend on r and not on time, so therefore instead of a rho dot we've got a p primed, but we've still got a very similar structure. Here we've got a primed on a. In cosmology, you would have the scale factor, little a, dot on a. So this looks, it's familiar, but it's just a little bit different. And so knowing what B is, having this relation, you've now got two first order equations. It's always nice when you've got first order equations. to solve one for the geometry, in the sense of it's for the metric function, and the other is for the matter. And so what you do, just like in cosmology, you assume an equation of state and then go ahead and solve and find the Friedman-Robertson-Walker family of universes. Here what we can do is make some assumption about our matter source and then see if we can integrate it up. So a simple model of a star is to say that the density profile has a very sharp cutoff, and this is known as a sort of top hat. So we assume our energy density literally is only non-zero inside the star, and it is constant inside the star. So in other words, I'm using a step function here, saying that if my r coordinate is less than some maximum value, then my density is a constant. So therefore, my total mass which, yep. How does
what's more realistic representation of rho?
Well, I mean, in reality, we know that the density is going to increase as we go to the centre of the star. But it's not so unreasonable to have a sharp cutoff, because mostly there is a relatively sharp cutoff at the boundary of, well, I mean, the Earth has a pretty sharp cutoff if you just think about it as the crust. So having a sharp edge is not so far off, okay? But I think that, you know, probably you would expect a much higher density in the middle than at the edges. So I think it's more the constancy that's maybe a bit more of an approximation than the cutoff. But it's having top hat profiles is not unusual when you're dealing with isolated objects in the universe. It's a very convenient way of getting intuition about how you know, how a particular isolated source might behave. Because although a real star is more complicated, in essence, you know, taking this sort of average description is going to tell you an awful lot about the sort of the basic physics of the object. And then if you get something which looks sensible with this assumption, then you can go back and start trying to make it more realistic. So it's the same process. I mean, you do the same thing in cosmology. You take homogeneity and isotropy, you get the Friedman-Robertson-Walker universes, and then you go back and say, right, let's make this a bit more detailed. And then you start sort of making your matter sources, you know, look at making those more sophisticated. And then, of course, you end up concluding that maybe, you know, you need inflation and you need to go a little bit beyond what you thought you had in the first place. But yes, it does look artificial, but it's not that far off. And it, as we'll see, it already gives us some quite interesting result about the space-time around one of these stars and about the existence of one of these solutions, which, whilst it's obviously in the context of this very simplified situation where I'm assuming perfect fluid, right, and this very sharp density profile, it's still giving something which is actually going to hint towards a very well-known physical result. So, you know, it's often better to do what you can first with simple examples and then build on them. I try, there's only one row. I try and make my row in one line, and it's more curvy. And I try and make my P in two strokes, and it's straight. So, I don't know. Yes, it is a problem. That's why I always try and have some... Yeah. No one above. I said there's only one row in this one, which is sitting there. So... And I'm told my writing's neat. So, okay. So if I have this top hat profile, so while I'm inside my star, the mass function is increasing like R cubed. Once I'm outside it, it's just gone to its background value. So, if I look at this conservation equation here, try and make my P's obvious here. Okie doke. So, let me just write, actually I thought I'd written it down, must have got distracted. M is 4/3 pi r cubed, rho naught. So, in the conservation of energy momentum equation, I know that my M of r is scaling like R cubed, and or it's constant. And my pressure also has an R cubed in front of it. So I can pull out that common factor. And I've replaced the overall mass there by the 4 pi R cubed rho naught. So here I've got P and rho naught. And on the bottom line, again, I've just replaced my M of R with its value over there, that bottom line. Okie doke. So that's a sort of first order differential equation for P, nonlinear, but it actually has a solution. So you can verify that for yourselves to see that that does indeed solve that differential equation. But you see appearing in it, you see things that look like the Schwarzschild potential. So you know, there's this sort of 1 minus 2 gm on r or something like that keeps cropping up. But what happens when you move to the outside of the star? This is chosen to make p equals 0 at the outside of the star. So you want to say that as you go to the edge of the star, the pressure vanishes, because outside the star, p is 0. But if we look now what happens inside the star, I'll look at what happens at r equals 0. Then, so the top line is non-zero, but the bottom line can actually blow up. So if we take our capital R to be 9 gm, do you want me 9 gm on 4? Yes, 9 gm on 4, so that 2 gm on R is 8 ninths, and you end up with 1 ninth under the square root, which gives you a third, then the bottom line vanishes. So in other words, it's saying that there is a limit to how big you can make one of these stars. So if I put in that expression for the overall mass in terms of this maximum radius, what this is telling us is that with a very simple model for this particular star, we find that we've actually got a problem. We can't just make it bigger and bigger and bigger, as big as we like. It's telling us there's a cutoff. There's an upper bound to the size, or correspondingly the mass, of one of these stars, after which we get into some sort of singularity. Now, here, of course, I've just taken this very, as I said, simple model. And we know that as soon as we start increasing pressure, such that the pressure starts to become comparable to the energy density, then we're entering into more of a relativistic situation. So we would not expect our perfect fluid to be a good approximation for matter. And we would have to, just like in cosmology, where we go back in time and the universe gets hotter, and we replace our perfect fluid with either an ideal gas or actually some statistical physics, gas of bosons or fermions. Same here. We have to, if we want to analyze stars properly, we would have to go in and start looking at a more realistic matter source inside the star. But of course, the fact is that this doesn't actually change this physical result, which is that there is a limit to the mass of the star. So this is known as the Chandrasekhar limit, after Chandrasekhar, who actually proved it, derived it. And it's telling us that we can't have arbitrarily big stars. Now, of course, again, that still doesn't tell us that black holes exist, but it's a very strong clue if normal physics, sort of standard particle physics, that we believe we understand, tells us that we cannot make a star that's arbitrarily heavy. Because when you have if you look at the sun and a star the size of the sun, we're not talking about very small distances. We're nowhere near the Planck scale. So we can't appeal to quantum gravity to save us from this particular result. We're sitting in a regime where we believe we understand gravity. We believe gravity is described by general relativity. We're not at high energy scales from a gravitational perspective. And we also believe the particle physics that we can do, because we're not at very strong curvatures either. And this tells us we can't make arbitrarily big stars. So therefore, that's telling us that we do expect black holes out there in the universe, because it's, so the Chandrasekhar limit is round about, just a little bit above the mass of the sun. And we know there are plenty of stars out there which are way more massive than the sun. And so when they come to the end of their lives, we would expect them to collapse and form a black hole. So next week, I want to talk a little bit more about black holes. We'll look at GD six-round black holes, which you've probably already done a bit of, and think about how this relates to observing black holes, and to also talk a little bit about rotating black holes. And then that will move us on to thinking about black holes more generally, talk about thermodynamics and other good things. Okay, any questions?
Realistic models.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm not so familiar with it, but yes, because of course people, you know, in terms of astrophysicists, people would want to know that these solutions make sense. I mean, with Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkoff, I've just written down the general equations for rho and p and the metric. So you always just put them on the computer and integrate them up. It's just that this is a simple example where you've got an analytic solution, and it's always useful to have in your arsenal a few models which you can write down explicitly. Toy models, so that you can explore properties and kind of develop your understanding. So, if you can actually work with them directly, somehow
it's easier
to understand.
So, if you get the Chandrasekhar limit, do they just assume the equation is state for a neutron star? Is it something like that?
Actually, I don't remember precisely what calculation he did. Initially, wasn't he not doing it? Wasn't he doing it initially for brown dwarfs when he first did it? Because there were a sequence of results, just like with all sorts of things here. And I think it was those sequence of results that led people to realise that there would be neutron stars, a sort of interim point on the way to a black hole. But Chandrasekhar was, I think, did it first. brown dwarfs rather than neutron stars, I think.
So, is there any significance to the fact that that number 9 GM over 4 is actually only slightly bigger than the Schwarzschild radius?
Well, in terms of the size, well, I mean, you'd expect it to be bigger than the Schwarzschild radius in the sense that we believe that if anything goes within its Schwarzschild radius, it is already inside a black hole. So, although there isn't actually a proof of that. But yes, it would have to be bigger because within 2 GM, you would expect it to already be within its Schwarzschild radius and therefore hidden from view. So in that case, it's saying that however much bigger, I suppose, that is than 2 GM is representing how much the matter has resisted collapsing, you know, until it eventually has to go. So, yeah, there is some significance to that. People need a break, don't they?